Chapter 4. Sensational Feet. Despite the blisters and bunions so often wrought by modern footwear, it remains all too easy to overlook the significance of our feet as sophisticated sensory organs, parts of our bodies we can use to feel, grasp, and keep in touch with the world. But our ancestors used their feet far more frequently to think with, to understand and manipulate the world in which they walked and worked. Whether threshing and milling grains and seeds, treading fruit, herding animals, rolling manure for fire bricks and fertilizer, turning the potter's wheel, weaving textiles and baskets, or measuring distance and time, the world was experienced through people's feet in ways increasingly unfamiliar in the modern age. Our ancestors were far more focused on their feet, literally more grounded, than most of us are today, and this naturally shaped their body practices and religious imaginations. In the cultures of ancient Southwest Asia, the feet were particularly precious sensory organs and had to be looked after. Happy feet were those that were washed and, for the wealthy, oiled several times a day to help prevent swelling, blistering, and skin cracking. A good pair of sandals that rarely needed patching was a prized commodity. Travellers petitioned the gods for wide, stable surfaces to walk upon, instead of the slip and scrape of unstable ground. They requested divine protection from thorns, stones, snake bites, and shoes that pinch. Cursed texts and malevolent incantations often targeted the feet of their victims. Shoelessness, skin diseases, hobbling, lameness, and toe amputation were particularly popular. In some biblical texts, as in other ancient legislative literature, retaliatory punishment or compensation for criminal offences demanded not only a life for a life and an eye for an eye, but a foot for a foot. Within this world, the feet of the gods were as tactile and as sensory as those of their worshippers. Just as human bodies experience the visceral carnage of warfare, the dry rustle of the threshing floor, or the squelch of the winepress, so too did the bodies of the gods. Mythic texts abound with detailed descriptions of their intense sensory experiences, some of which border on the monstrous. When she goes on the rampage against humans, the fearsome warrior goddess Anat is up to her knees as she wades in the blood of soldiers, up to her neck in the gore of fighters. It's a sensation she enjoys so much that when she returns home, she transforms the chairs and tables in her dining hall into an army of living victims, fresh for trampling. Not one to be outdone by his older Ugaritic cousin, the god of the Bible also showcases his martial expertise by excessive body trampling. In a particularly graphic scene in Isaiah, the deity recasts the horror of the battlefield as the joy of the village harvest. A lookout in Jerusalem sees Yahweh marching back towards the city from an attack on the enemy kingdom of Edom, his clothing blotched with crimson stains. "Why are your robes red and your garments like theirs who tread the winepress?" asked the sentry. "I have trodden the winepress," Yahweh declares. "I trod them in my anger and trampled them in my wrath. Their juice spattered on my garments and stained all my robes." Keen to ensure his metaphor has not been misunderstood, the deity spells it out. "I trampled down peoples in my anger. I crushed them in my wrath. I poured out their lifeblood on the earth." This is a god who has felt the crunch of bones and skulls under his feet, the warm, wet mulch of human flesh around his ankles, the hot spray of blood on his legs. It's an ancient vision of divine bloodlust heartily embraced by successive generations of his worshippers, including the writer of the New Testament book of Revelation. In this esoteric, fantastical work depicting the cosmic battles that will bring about the world to come, the apocalypse is a bloody day of reckoning. God uses an enormous winepress outside Jerusalem to kill his earthly enemies. Humans are harvested with a sickle like grapes from the vine and thrown into God's wine vat. The flood of blood gushing from the press rises as high as a horse's bridle, soaking an area of 1,600 stadia, a vast distance of about 200 miles. The bloodied robes of the divine vintner are transferred to Christ, who's clothed in them when he appears from the heavens upon a white war horse, ready for the final battle for Jerusalem, when he too will tread the divine winepress. His white linen robes, stained with the scarlet smears of blood, would be evoked by the pale tunics decorated with blood-red crosses worn by medieval Europe's Christian armies in their crusades against the ungodly of the Holy Land. But if we should expect to find traces of blood between God's toes and around his legs, so too we would find on his feet the dewy residues of his calmer moments. Many deities were known to enjoy walking, whether in their gardens, their temples, or around their cities. In Genesis, Yahweh is said to walk regularly in his Garden of Eden at the time of the evening breeze, a fleeting but evocative detail conjuring the impression of a deity enjoying a stroll at the end of the day, his feet cooling as they brush through lush vegetation. Outside the garden, however, walking could be hazardous, and Yahweh was at risk of stepping in something unpleasant if he didn't take the necessary precautions. It's for this reason that he issues the Israelites travelling from Egypt to the Promised Land with special instructions for defecation. You shall have a designated area outside the camp to which you shall go. With your utensils you shall have a trowel, and when you relieve yourself outside, you shall dig a hole with it and then cover up your excrement, because Yahweh your God walks in your camp. Walking might also come with added benefits. In a world in which mobility offered additional opportunities for socialising, travel was often associated with the forging of new familial and economic relationships. In particular, it was a chance for men to acquire brides and for fathers to marry off their daughters. The mythologies of this world suggest that the gods might similarly have encountered new lovers as they walked about. In a Sumerian myth, the high deity Enlil is out for a stroll along a riverbank when he meets the goddess Ninlil, resulting in the two having repeated and rampant sex. Similarly, at Ugarit, Eil's bracing walk along the seashore leads to a highly erotic sexual encounter with two young goddesses who consequently bear him divine children. For Yahweh, however, walking was stimulating in other ways. It was an opportunity for amiable male companionship. Enoch, Noah, and Abraham are all said to have walked with God, an activity more usually undertaken by minor deities such as Refesh and Dever, terrifying purveyors of plague and pestilence who march alongside him in his marauding army. But when humans walk with Yahweh, their close physical proximity to the deity marks their likeness to the divine. They are blameless or righteous in the world and blemish-free in body, and hence set apart or made holy for Yahweh's exclusive attention and company. Scholars usually interpret this as an elaborate theological metaphor, so that in the Bible, to walk with God is to fall into religious step with him, a notion echoed in the Arabic term sharia, path or way, which is used to describe the function of Islamic law as a guide to divine will. But on occasion, the biblical writers seem to have understood walking with God as a more corporeal activity. Abraham is portrayed as literally walking and talking with Yahweh and two of his divine colleagues on the road from Mamre towards Sodom. And Yahweh enjoys Enoch's company so much that even after 300 years of walking the earth together, the deity decides to lift him into the heavenly realm, where in a rich collection of early Jewish and Christian literature, Enoch continues to travel about heaven's various dimensions, meeting its angelic inhabitants. For Yahweh, walking in step with his worshippers was a form of male bonding, and shaped the very essence of his special relationship with the Israelites, who are consistently gendered as the sons of Jacob or Israel. "I will walk among you," he says, "I will be God to you, and you will be my people." It may be that companionship was Yahweh's goal when he went for his evening stroll in the Garden of Eden, for as he walks, he's on the lookout for Adam. But Adam is nowhere to be seen. "Where are you?" he calls out, like the frustrated loser in a game of hide-and-seek, and laying to rest any idea that the God of the Bible is omniscient and omnipotent. A near-naked Adam emerges from the foliage and shyly confesses to Yahweh that he could hear the sound of him walking, and so had time to conceal his newly realised nudity among the trees. God's feet may have been sensuously receptive to the pleasures of the garden, but they were also very noisy. Noisy feet were not usually a problem for the gods. Rather, the sonorous impact of divine footfall was a certain indication to humans in the earthly realm of the ongoing activity of their deities. The loud, heavy marching of the gods caused the earth to tremble and the mountains to quake, just as they did when Yahweh processed an imperial victory from his wilderness home to take possession of the land of Canaan. Oh, Yahweh, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the steppe of Edom, the earth trembled, his worshippers gleefully sang. The mountains quaked before Yahweh, he of Sinai, before Yahweh, the God of Israel. The noise of the gods' footsteps might also function as a siren in the earthly realm, triggering holy war between nations and their deities. In the books of Samuel, an oracle instructs King David to listen out for the sound of the wind in a grove of trees before launching an attack on the Philistines. When you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then be on the alert, for then Yahweh has gone out before you to strike down the army. Along with marching, foot pounding was also particularly popular with warrior deities and typical of the gods at Ugarit, who frequently punctuated their arguments and declarations of war with ferocious stamping. It was a clear signal of divine rage, as the good-looking hero Akkat discovered when he refused to give his magical bow and arrows to the goddess Anat. "I'll make you fall under my feet, pretty boy, He-Man," she threatens, stamping her feet so hard that the earth shook. This ancient idea survived well into later periods, so that even in rabbinic literature, earth tremors were sometimes thought to be caused by God pounding his feet in fury or vengeance. The gods are not often described as having quiet feet. As divine beings, they rarely felt the need to move by stealth. But if they did, they might remove their shoes so as to muffle the sound of their footsteps, particularly when they risked journeying into the underworld. Pitched as a place of dimmed light and hushed noise, the requirement that visitors to the underworld remove their sturdy travelling shoes not only warned that they might not be able to return home, but lessened the disruptive imposition of their presence. The removal of footwear mattered far more to the gods in other ways. Their worshippers were often expected to take off their shoes before praying or stepping inside a place of worship, an ancient custom inherited by Islam and required of anyone entering a mosque today. Although this practice is shared with other religious groups, including Hindus, Sikhs, and Buddhists, in Islam, it arguably derives in part from much older religious preferences, attested in some societies across ancient Southwest Asia and the Eastern Mediterranean, in which barefootedness played an important sensory role for both humans and gods. The art and inscriptions of ancient Egypt suggest that barefootedness was a common ritual prerequisite to entering a temple. This was sacred space, the place of the feet of the gods, and so the feet of priests and worshippers were to be unshod and washed before they could tread where the gods stepped. As a further precaution, a ritual known as the bringing of the foot was undertaken by priests and other cult functionaries who used a magical broom to sweep the floor as they backed away from the altar, removing human footprints from the sanctuary. Ritual foot washing and floor and wall cleansing was practiced across Mesopotamia too, where the appropriate management of disruptive dirt inside sacred space demanded not cleaners, but exorcists, skilled in the safe manipulation and eradication of otherworldly dust. It's against this wider cultural backdrop that certain ritual forms of shoe removal and foot washing in the biblical world are best understood. Barefootedness appears to have been the norm for priests in Yahweh's temples, for references to footwear are conspicuously absent in biblical and early Jewish descriptions of priestly vestments, while certain ritual prescriptions attest to the daubing of blood or water on the bare feet and toes of the priests once they moved inside Yahweh's sanctuaries. By the Roman period, most Jewish communities across Palestine were engaging in regular ritual foot washing. The jugs, troughs, and small clay foot basins of older centuries were gradually supplemented or replaced at sacred sites and synagogues with a specially constructed bathing pool called the mikveh. This stepped stone structure allowed groups of worshippers to cleanse not only their feet, but their whole bodies, accommodating the communal water immersion practices popular with groups as diverse as Jerusalem-based Torah scholars, the Dead Sea Scrolls community, and the followers of holy men like John the Baptist and Jesus of Nazareth. By this time, the priestly prerogative to go barefoot when worshipping Yahweh already appears to have been extended to all those who might step onto Jerusalem's Temple Mount. It was far from sufficient simply to remove sandals. All feet had to be richly cleansed before they could come into contact with holy ground. To ascend the Temple Mount to God's dwelling place was to enter into the heavens, and as the Jewish philosopher Philo of Alexandria put it, the washing of feet means that we should no longer walk on the earth, but sweep through the heights of the ether. Writing in the 1st century CE, shortly before the destruction of the temple, Philo claimed that even the hooves of sacrificial animals were washed before they stepped into the temple precinct. After all, according to the saying, one should not enter with unwashed feet on the pavement of the temple of God. It was an ancient religious requirement that had been famously flouted in 167 BCE by the Seleucid king Antiochus IV Epiphanes when he looted the Jerusalem temple to fund his military campaigns. This shocking event triggered painful cultural memories of the Babylonian desecration of the temple in the 6th century BCE, moving a Jewish poet to pen a bitter lament, berating the foreigners who arrogantly trampled the sanctuary of God with their sandals. It was one thing for outsiders to trample the temple, but quite another for Yahweh's own worshippers to defile the place of his feet in Jerusalem. In the highly volatile context of the Greco-Roman era, in which religious control of the city was repeatedly sought and contested by both establishment and sectarian Jewish groups, accusations of temple defilement were common. Writing in the 1st century CE, the Jewish historian Josephus employs this rhetorical weapon against the zealots, whom he claims entered the sanctuary with polluted feet. More sensationally, this is precisely what Jesus is also said to have done. A fragmentary papyrus manuscript found amid a cache of documents in an ancient rubbish tip at the Egyptian site of Oxyrhynchus preserves an otherwise unattested story about Jesus and his disciples. Dating from the first half of the 2nd century CE, the text describes Jesus and his disciples wandering about the Jerusalem temple and the shocked response of a high priest who discovers them there. "Who gave you permission to walk in this place of purification and look upon these holy vessels when you have not bathed and your disciples have not washed their feet?" the priest demands. Jesus answers back with a vicious denunciation of Jewish purification rites, insultingly belittling their function and the high priest himself. "You've washed in this running water in which dogs and pigs have wallowed night and day, and you've washed and scrubbed your outer skin, which harlots and flute girls also anoint and wash and scrub, beautifying themselves for the lusts of men, while inwardly they're filled with scorpions and unrighteousness of every kind." While this story is not out of keeping with the Gospel's portrayal of a frequently confrontational and hostile Jesus, its sharp anti-Jewish polemic suggests it's probably a later invention, reflecting disputes among Christian Jewish communities of the 2nd century CE about the relative value of traditional purity rituals vis-a-vis Christian baptism. Nevertheless, it's a good illustration of the continued perception that unclean feet were not to tread on the temple's holy ground. After the religiously cataclysmic destruction of the Jerusalem temple by the Roman general Titus in 70 CE, the removal of shoes was a ritual transferred from temple priests to rabbis officiating synagogues across ancient Palestine. While the Babylonian Talmud suggests it was not a practice necessarily expected in the synagogues of ancient diaspora communities, it was popular among some groups. And it's a tradition in the worship of the Jewish God that survived in part today. While barefootedness in synagogues is not required, in Orthodox services, males of priestly descent, kohanim, will remove their shoes when proclaiming the priestly benediction. In the ancient world, all these activities reflected the notion that shoes were a symbol of power. To wear them inside a temple was to assert a social dominance entirely inappropriate in the presence of the gods, a view that would encourage a social preference among ancient pilgrims across the Eastern Mediterranean to travel in barefooted humility. But bare feet were also quiet feet. High-ranking gods, especially those among the oldest generations, enjoyed periods of peace and quiet as much as the rest of us, and might easily be provoked to anger should the smack and slap of noisy sandals in their temples become too loud. Indeed, humans had long been known as inherently noisy creatures. In the Mesopotamian epic Atrahasis, dated to about 1700 BCE, the high god Enlil famously decides to kill off humans with a great flood because, he says, the noise of mankind has become too much. I'm losing sleep over their racket. It's an episode which speaks to a divine distaste for excessive human noise, well attested for millennia across ancient Southwest Asia and the Eastern Mediterranean. The truly pious were often characterized as those who conducted themselves quietly in temples. In an Egyptian text of the 18th dynasty, circa 1550 to 1305 BCE, the god Amun was quite understandably said to love the silent one more than the one with a loud voice. In Greece, several centuries later, even Socrates, denounced by his opponents for not believing in the gods of the Athenian state, was teasingly demanding silence from his debating partner, for, he said, there seems to be a divine presence in this spot. The god of the Bible similarly preferred limited words and muffled feet. In the book of Ecclesiastes, known in Jewish tradition as Koheleth, worshippers are advised to guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Let your words be few. Shoeless feet were quiet feet, and quiet feet were the feet of the devout. It was not only a divine aversion to human noisiness that encouraged shoelessness among worshippers. As many of these foot-focused traditions and rituals reveal, barefootedness also expressed concerns across the ancient world about ritual purity. The dust, dirt, and decay of the ordinary world outside a temple could not be allowed to pollute the purity or cleanness of the ground inside the temple. Ritual washing before, and sometimes after, entering sacred space enabled priests and worshippers to maintain an embodied distinction between the sacred and the profane, and so guard against the dangerous wrath of the gods, who might punish transgressors with death or, worse, reject the whole community by abandoning their dwelling places. In Roman-era Judah, the bodily dynamics of traditional worship would render human feet overtly political. Although he's more usually remembered as a baby killer, King Herod's legacy is more reliably represented by his impressive building projects, many of which were designed to enrich, quite literally, holy sites across his realm. Most significant was his large-scale renovation of the Jerusalem Temple, which expanded its outer courtyards to accommodate ever larger numbers of pilgrims and foreign visitors during festivals. But by the time his ambitious plans had come to fruition in about 64 CE, nearly 70 years after his death, non-Jewish people were strictly prohibited from setting foot inside the temple's precincts. Bodily purity was a ritual state of such importance that allowing anybody other than Yahweh's own worshippers to approach the deity's dwelling place risked unclean feet trampling dangerous ritual pollutants across holy ground. According to Josephus, the stone balustrade surrounding the temple's precincts carried inscriptions giving warning, some in Greek, others in Latin characters, of the law of purification, to wit that no foreigner was allowed to enter the holy place. Some of these inscriptions have been found, the most complete of which is now in the Istanbul Archaeological Museum. Written in Greek, it reads, "No foreigner is to enter within the balustrade and forecourt around the sacred precinct. Whoever is caught will himself be responsible for his consequent death." Over time, anxieties about ritual impurities carried by the feet would morph into a fuzzier cultural understanding within many societies that the shoes and feet of humans were potentially antisocial because of their intense, frequent contact with the ground beyond the bounds of sacred space. Accordingly, feet and shoes are today carefully managed outside as well as inside places of worship in a number of communities. As is well known, it's now customary to remove shoes upon entering a Muslim home. In Orthodox Jewish communities, shoes are not to be worn indoors during periods of mourning, nor on Yom Kippur, when even among liberal Jewish groups, the decaying materials of leather shoes are often to be swapped in favour of bare feet or synthetic fabrics. In some Eastern Mediterranean and Middle Eastern societies, it's often inappropriate to show the soles of the feet, and the bottoms of shoes must not come into contact with other parts of the body, a cultural concern powerfully harnessed on screens around the world in 2008 when Iraqi journalist Muntaza al-Zaidi protested against the Iraq war by throwing his polluting shoes at US President George W. Bush during a press conference. But just as purity regulations in the ancient world safeguarded divine presence in temples and sanctuaries, so too they protected human communities in their own spaces. Shoe removal at a temple prevented the holiness of sacred ground being tracked unchecked out of the temple and into the streets of the ordinary world. The extraordinary ground of temples contained something of the material properties of divine presence transmitted from the feet of the gods, which demanded careful handling. Just as a spellcaster might use soil taken from a footprint or dust wiped from the feet of a man to cause him harm, so too the dust from the temple floor on which the gods walked might be used in magical incantations. And the biblical writers were well aware of this. In one of the more unsettling religious laws in the Book of Numbers, compiled in about the 5th century BCE, any woman accused of adultery is to be brought into Yahweh's sanctuary to stand before the priest and the deity. The priest mixes some dust from the floor of the sanctuary into a vessel containing holy water, into which has been dissolved the ink from a written curse. May this water that brings the curse enter your bowels and make your womb discharge, your uterus drop, incants the priest. The woman drinks the potion. If she suffers a miscarriage, she's guilty of adultery and will be estranged from the community. If she suffers no ill effects, she's innocent, and any child she subsequently bears will be recognised as that of her husband. It's the numinous power of sacred space, materialised in its very earth and stone, that ultimately underlies ancient religious preferences for shoe removal. Barefootedness enabled the worshipper to come safely but intimately into direct physical contact with the divine. And it's this feet-first approach to the gods which underlies one of the most famous stories of barefooted holy men in Western culture, that of Moses and the burning bush in the Book of Exodus. The story is set in the wilderness on Mount Horeb, an alternative name for Sinai, and describes Moses' first encounter with Yahweh. Moses is tending his father-in-law's flock of goats when he comes upon a thorn bush that's mysteriously engulfed but undamaged by flames. As he pauses, intending to take a closer look, God calls out to him from within the bush. Come no closer! Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place, Makom, on which you are standing is holy ground. Obeying the deity's instructions, Moses approaches the God in the bush. The two have a lengthy conversation, but Moses is compelled to cover his face because he was afraid to look at God. Temporarily blinded, Moses' encounter with the deity is sustained not by sight, but by bare feet, feet that feel the sacred ground in which the bush itself is rooted. In the southern Sinai, a towering bramble enshrined within a sunny courtyard in the monastery of the God-trodden Mount is traditionally identified as the very place where Moses first met Yahweh. Nestled in a rocky gorge at the foot of the holy mountain, the monastery itself is better known as St. Catherine's and was formally founded by the Eastern Roman Emperor Justinian in the 6th century CE. It's home to some of the oldest religious art of the Byzantine world, including the stunning golden mosaics that shimmer on the apse and triumphal arch in the Justinian Basilica. Here, there are two dazzling images of a po-faced Moses on the holy mountain. One shows him as a rugged young man taking off his sandals before a bright green bush alive with dancing red flames. The other shows him as an aging, exhausted elder standing barefoot on Sinai's peak as God's hand plunges out of the sky to give him the Ten Commandments. In both mosaics, Moses continues to model good practice for his monastic audience, for abutting the external wall of the apse is the older 4th century chapel of the burning bush, next to which the revered bush grows. Today, The monks of St. Catherine's are still required to remove their shoes before stepping inside to pray before its Holy of Holies, said to be located directly above the roots of the sacred bush. Shoe removal at the Chapel of the Burning Bush is just one of a number of barefooted rituals to survive into the monotheisms of the modern era. Whether Jewish, Christian or Muslim, and whether habitual or episodic, shoe removal and barefootedness remains a powerful sensory experience in the religious lives of millions of worshippers today, echoing very ancient encounters with sacred ground. Foot fetish. Shortly after his election to papal office in 2013, Pope Francis appalled conservative Roman Catholics across the world by bathing, drying, and kissing the feet of two women during the foot washing ceremony of Easter week. Closely aligned to the Last Supper narrative in the Gospel of John, in which Jesus is portrayed as washing his disciples' feet, the Roman Catholic ritual traditionally restricted recipients of the practice to selected male members of the congregation, a convention only enshrined in Holy Week liturgy in 1956. Many critics voiced their discomfort at the Pope's breaching of church law, protesting that the maleness of the disciples should be faithfully represented by male participants in the rite, the same objection long levelled against those in favour of the ordination of women to the priesthood. But the Pope persisted and has washed and kissed the feet of women and those of non-Christians every Easter since, supporting his actions with a papal decree in 2016 and advising that, where possible, women should be included in the ceremony. Protesters continued to object. Some insisted it's the authoritative status of church law and not institutionalised gender inequality that necessitates the exclusion of women from the ritual. Foot washing is too important to be dragged into a feminist debate, asserted the headline in one Roman Catholic newspaper. Others, however, appear to be more unsettled by the Pope and his priests performing such an intimate body ritual with women. From the underbelly of liturgical conservatism re-emerged a deeply rooted misogynistic anxiety about the dangerous sexuality of women and their feet. In Kazakhstan, for example, Bishop Athanasius Schneider of Astana, now Nur-Sultan, responded to the papal decree by publicly declaring the washing and kissing of women's feet improper and even indecent, while in the UK, the Latin Mass Society of England and Wales published a statement expressing concerns about the etiquette of men washing the feet of women as an activity that would have been considered inappropriate only a few decades ago in the West. To bathe and kiss the feet of another is an act of intense intimacy, embarrassingly so for some Christians, as modern religious commentators have often noted. Consequently, church theologians are often keen to emphasise the ancient heritage of the ritual in mitigating any discomfort around its intimacy. In the hierarchical societies of 1st century CE Roman Palestine, they point out, foot washing was one of the duties of a servant or slave, whose own body was merely a tool for servicing that of his or her overlord. As such, when Jesus washes his disciples' feet in the Last Supper in the Gospel of John, it's to be read as an act of servile humility, enacting the deliberate self-abasement of the Master, Jesus, to his servants, the disciples. But in the highly loaded imagery of the Gospel, Jesus' actions also carry a far weightier religious freight, and they're not quite as humble as they might appear. This is a Gospel in which Jesus' actions move beyond the symbolic to serve instead as carefully coded revelatory performances, which point insistently to his divinity. "You do not know what I'm doing, but later you will understand," Jesus says as he crouches at Peter's feet, who's utterly confused by proceedings and protesting loudly. "You will never wash my feet," he declares. Realising he has to make things clearer, Jesus tells the disciples he's making their feet ritually clean, in other words, physically ready to enter into the presence of the divine, in keeping with the conventions of Jewish temple practice. "Unless I wash you, you have no share with me," he says, warning his followers that they will lose their place alongside him if their feet are not ritually pure, and thereby claiming that he himself is the grounded locus of divine presence among his disciples. This is a divine presence repeatedly manifested by Jesus' feet in early Christian literature. Although first century CE rabbis were accustomed to their students and followers sitting at their feet, the biblical portrayal of Jesus' feet often elevates his status beyond that of a religious teacher and casts him instead as a divine figure. Like the ancient gods before him, Jesus tramples the chaotic waters of the raging sea into quiet submission. When the sick and infirm are placed at his feet, they're healed by his life-giving powers. In the Gospels, followers frequently fall at Jesus' feet, where some are explicitly said to worship him. It's an action often accompanied by his devotees clutching or kissing his feet, much as gods and their cult statues were grasped and kissed on the feet in myths and rituals throughout ancient Southwest Asia and the Eastern Mediterranean. In Hebrew Bible texts, on which the earliest Christians drew to support their claims about Jesus' divinity, it's an act of ritual veneration performed in honour of gods and divinely anointed kings. Indeed, in Psalm 2, one of the most important scriptural passages used by early Christians to support their claims that Jesus was the Son of God and royal Messiah, in Greek Christos, worshippers are pointedly instructed to kiss the divine feet. The veneration of Jesus' feet is most explicitly expressed in the story in Luke's Gospel about a woman who seeks out Jesus while he's dining at the house of a Pharisee, a member of a conservative group of Torah specialists. Described as a sinner and given no name, although often assumed to be Mary Magdalene, she positions herself at Jesus' feet as he reclines at the table, weeping so much that she floods tears upon them. She bathes his feet with her tears and rubs them dry with her unbound hair, a style more usually seen publicly on women venerating the gods in a sanctuary or performing mourning rituals. Her flood of tears becomes a rain of kisses. "She's not stopped kissing my feet," Jesus approvingly observes, while she anoints and massages his feet with a rich ointment. The ritualized nature of her actions is impossible to miss. She washes and anoints Jesus' feet as priests in a temple would wash and anoint the cult statue of a god, simultaneously acknowledging and marking its sacred status. But the intense sensuality of the scene also communicates an eroticism many have found discomforting, including the Pharisee in the story, who's shocked that Jesus should let a sinful woman touch him in such a way. It's a scene emphasizing the overwhelming sensuous excesses of her body. By using her flowing hair, wet skin, and the repeated actions of her mouth and hands to caress Jesus' feet, her actions take on the characteristics of sexual stimulation and erotic play, as seen in visual and literary works across the contemporaneous Greco-Roman world, including Petronius's Satyricon, where long-haired slave boys anoint the feet of diners at a lascivious banquet, winding garlands around their ankles. It's an experience Luke's Jesus endorses at the close of the story and is one of the most erotically charged scenes in the Gospels. Against this backdrop, the story in the later Gospel of John, describing Jesus washing his disciples' feet, looks rather more suggestive. Stripping off his clothes and wrapping a towel around his waist, Jesus positions himself at the feet of his closest companions to perform a bathing ritual of sensory service, wiping his disciples' feet dry with the towel about his groin and encouraging them to do the same to each other. It becomes a sensuous encounter, binding Jesus and his disciples together into a shared and intense bodily relationship. The erotic undertones of these biblical episodes are often missed by modern readers unfamiliar with the cultural contours of the ancient world and unaccustomed to the notion of a sexualized Christ. But for the earliest followers of Jesus, steeped in Jewish traditions, the feet were already eroticized and closely associated with sexual activity, and in the Hebrew Bible, they often serve euphemistically as a stand-in for genitalia. In the Book of Ruth, for example, the eponymous heroine is instructed by her dead husband's mother to seduce the landowner Boaz by oiling herself with perfume, uncovering his feet while he's asleep, and positioning herself there. "And then he will tell you what to do," her mother-in-law adds, with the voice of experience. Ruth remains at Boaz's feet all night and succeeds in conceiving a child. Elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible, husbands wet their feet with or in their wives at home.
Women's skirts are forcefully lifted to expose their feet in public acts of sexual abuse and humiliation. Wanton women whose genitalia deserve to be shamefully exposed are those who jingle with their feet as they walk in sandals and anklets decorated with tiny bells. And adulterous women are those whose feet do not stay at home, but walk about the city by night and stand on street corners. These biblical traditions reflect a sexualizing of the feet attested in Mesopotamian literature of a similar period. In a 7th century BCE Assyrian text, for example, the scribe god Nabu praises the goddess Tashmetu with enraptured delight as the divine woman whose thighs are a gazelle in the plain, whose ankle bones are an apple of Simeon, whose heels are obsidian, whose whole being is a tablet of lapis lazuli. It's a lyrical expression of sexual desire akin to the biblical Song of Songs, in which the male lover revels in the erotic beauty of his beloved's legs and feet. How graceful are your feet in sandals, O queenly maiden! Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Against this rich cultural backdrop, the fetishizing of Jesus' feet as the site of both religious and erotic veneration is unsurprising and persistent. Extending across centuries of Christianity, sexualized encounters with Christ's feet litter the religious works of theologians, bishops, monks, and mystics. In the closing decades of the 4th century, Jerome was battling his sexual urges while on ascetic retreat in the Syrian desert, likening himself to the sensuous sinner of Luke's gospel. Helpless, I cast myself at the feet of Jesus. I watered them with my tears. I wiped them with my hair. And then I subdued my rebellious body with weeks of abstinence. At around the same time, Bishop Paulinus of Nola was fantasizing about touching the heel of Christ with the tip of his tongue so that he could lick the divine feet. In the 12th century, the Cistercian monk Bernard of Clairvaux was writing with fevered passion about his desire to move his mouth up the body of Christ, his tender lover, kissing first his feet, and then his hand, and then his mouth. In the 15th century, the English mystic Marjorie Kemp was caressing Christ's feet and toes in a series of erotic visions in which he commanded her to treat him as her lover and her husband. The fixation with divine feet was not confined to Christians during this lengthy period. Within ancient and medieval Judaism too, some rabbis rhetorically stripped and gazed upon the body of God, fixing their eyes particularly on his feet as the anatomical parts traditionally associated in the Hebrew Bible with the revelation of the divine body. From as early as the 2nd century CE and continuing into the 8th, rabbinic debate about the presence of God frequently circled back to biblical references to God's feet and footstool. In contrast to a theological preference in mainstream Judaism today to read these references metaphorically or symbolically, certain rabbinic traditions celebrated the wonder of God's feet in ways that married the mysterious, transcendent nature of God with ever more tangible ways of experiencing his presence. Accordingly, in some Talmudic and Midrashic texts, it's assumed that God leaves human-like footprints on the rocks and mountains on which he stands. In others, the feet of God are so intimate a part of his body that he conceals them from human eyes, but reveals their impact in the world in the clouds of dust he kicks up as he walks. Even the personified Shekinah, the indwelling or presence of God in the world, was assumed by some rabbis to have feet, which might be revealed or concealed by clouds or be soiled or pushed away from the earth by the transgressions of worshippers. In early Jewish mysticism, intense scholarly speculation about the corporeal nature of God's feet climaxed with the Shi'ur Koma, or measurement of the body, a literary collection of much older traditions in circulation by the 12th century CE. In this work, the measurements of God's body were calculated and the secret names of its anatomical parts discerned. In particular, the claim in the book of Isaiah that the earth was the footstool of God was taken as a handy guide to the enormous size of God's feet, measured in spatial units known as parasangs, each one roughly equivalent to 3 miles. The soles of his feet fill the entire universe, as it said, the heavens are my throne and the earth is my footstool. The length of his soles is 30 million parasangs. From his foot till his ankle, the distance is 10,500 parasangs in its height on the right side, and thus also on the left. In measuring the feet of God, Jewish mystics were not trying to impoverish the glory of God by rendering him more like a man, as an appalled Maimonides, or Rambam, contested in the 12th century CE. Rather, they were using a specialized religious logic to demonstrate the incomprehensible, uncontainable nature of the divine. To a certain extent, the medieval mystical tradition was keeping alive God's ancient mythological past in ways classical rabbinic Judaism and Western Christianity could not, or would not. But it's within a collection of medieval mystical traditions known as the Zohar that the fetishization of God's feet is most explicitly sexualized. Emerging in 13th century Spain, but claimed to derive from the visions and homilies of a wandering band of Roman-era Palestinian sages and rabbis, the Zohar decodes and then recodes biblical texts and Jewish teachings, and is the foundational literature of later Kabbalah and Hasidism. At its heart is the notion that something of the inscrutable, infinite God, Ein Sof, can be grasped via the world of the Sephirot, the 10 interactive dimensions or emanations of God in the created world, such as goodness, justice, separation and wisdom, by which humans can experience divine responsiveness. Within this highly esoteric, multi-layered theological scheme, God is not only embodied, but the divine body comprises male and female principles, which can engage tenderly and sexually with one another. Encouraged by the biblical tendency to associate the feet with genitalia, the sexualized masculinity of God, a form of the ninth dimension, known as Yesod, is frequently correlated with his feet, with which the feminine aspect of the presence of God, Shekhinah, cast as the tenth dimension, engages and unites erotically and sexually. In the Zohar, God's feet become powerfully coded symbols of the spiritualized divine penis. It's often assumed that this highly specialized, mystical sexualizing of God's feet was a scandalous but anomalous innovation of its time, but this is mistaken. The fetishizing of the divine feet was already a well-established feature of centuries of Jewish and Christian traditions. The medieval mystics contributing to the Zohar were simply drawing anew on a rich biblical heritage of cosmic mythology in order to better understand the intimate relationship between God and humans. Deeply embedded within this mythology was the ancient idea that God had always been a sexual deity, and in the Bible, he had the genitals to prove it.